There was a remarkable Rav. He was remarkable in many ways, and maybe the most notable was his longevity, well over 100 years old. The Rav of the Yishuv HaYashan in Yerushalayim, Rav Shmuel Salant, for the better part of the 19th century into the 20th century, Rav Shmuel Salant was a Lithuanian, Eastern European born Gaon who moved to Israel. He made Aliyah in 1841. And he spent, I think, 7 decades as the chief rabbi of the Yishuv HaYashan. He was known posek, a very, very strong traditionalist. He was significant in his opposition to many of the Zionist ideas, and he was a very, very significant Torah personality. In 1860, he traveled to Germany. And years later, in the beginning of the 20th century, he had a conversation reflecting on this visit. He visited Germany and he met with a very distinguished, important, chashuv German Rav, who was known as the Wurzburger Rav. The Wurzburger Rav welcomed him, and they had several conversations about German Jewry. And Rav Shmuel Salant reflected on this 40-plus years later in a conversation with Rabbi Joseph Karlbach, Zecher Tzadik Levrach Hashem Yikom Damo. Rabbi Joseph Karlbach was an important German rabbinic figure. We could talk a lot more about him. He perished in the Holocaust. And he recorded this conversation that he had with Rav Shmuel Salant when he went to Israel, and he met with Rav Shmuel Salant, and Rav Shmuel Salant was reflecting on his experience of being in Germany almost 50 years earlier, and how noteworthy and significant and what an impression it made on him to meet with the Wurzburger Rav. He came to the shul of the Wurzburger Rav, and Rav Shmuel Salant said he was very surprised. He was very surprised because, you know, it says in Shulchan Aruch that when you build a shul, the bima is supposed to be situated like this. Bima be'emtza. And they had a German word for it, and I apologize in advance for all the German words that I'm going to mispronounce or just skip out of just Rachmanis for the rest of you. The bima was at the front of the shul. So Rav Shmuel Salant was in this shul, and Rav Shmuel Salant was a very strong, fiery personality. At that time, he was still very young. He comes to the shul. He's in a German milieu in 1860. In the Wurzburger Rav's shul, the bima is all the way at the front. Now, where would you find a shul where you had the bima all the way at the front in 1860? That's right, in a Reform congregation. Because Reform and its movement was whipping across German Jewry. So you know what's interesting? Rav Shmuel Salant, Zichron Levracha, remarked to Rabbi Karlbach, he said, I saw this, but I didn't say anything. Why didn't I say anything? Because the Wurzburger Rav, if it was good enough for him, who am I to ask? Who am I to question? This is Rav Shmuel Salant speaking. So after davening, Rav Shmuel Salant says they had a whole conversation. Because who am I to speak in front of the Wurzburger Rav? But the Wurzburger Rav says to him, he says, you might be wondering why the construction of this shul is the way that it is. And Rav Shmuel Salant said to him, you know, I kind of noticed that, but I didn't want to say, you know, you. So he said, he explained to me, he said, you have to understand, in this community, in this milieu right now, we are locked in a bitter struggle with the reformers in the community, and we have to make certain decisions, And those decisions sometimes require leniencies that we wouldn't employ anywhere else. But it's for the life and death of our community, we need to make this decision. This was the conversation. Who was the Wurzburger Rav? His name was Rav Selig Bamberger. You see on the left side of your first page, this is a special plaque which is dedicated to him in the town of Wurzburger, Rabbiner Seligman Bear Bamberger. This was the man who was the staunch leader, respected Rav and Gon, who even Rav Shmuel Salant wouldn't question about his decisions in his shul. So Rav Bamberger, the Wurzburger Rav, he has a public article. He has a notice that he puts out there a few years later. And this becomes the source of tremendous controversy. And it's interesting to think about, to learn about, because even though Rav Bamberger was in 1860 one of the most prominent rabbinic personalities in all of Germany, he wasn't the only prominent rabbinic personality in Germany. And just a few short years later, he's going to come in direct conflict. His public letter that was printed is going to come in conflict with another tremendous Torah personality in Germany in the 19th century, in the person of, that's right, Rabbi Samson Reifovich. And what was the bitter and difficult controversy, machlokas, between the Wurzburger Rav, Rav Seligman Bear Bamberger, and Rav Shimshon Mufal Hirsch in Frankfurt am Main? It was about something that we call, I guess we call it in English, the shortened version of German in English called Ausgut. And let's explain what that was and who we're talking about. I think everybody here just acknowledged that they're familiar with Rav Shimshon Mufal Hirsch, who was the Talmud of two great German rabbinic luminaries, the Chacham Bernays, and also Rav Yaakov Tzvi Ettlinger. Rav Hirsch, he was referred to by the Ger Rebbe. The Ger Rebbe referred to him as a living Sefer Torah. He was somebody who transformed the German Jewish community. In 1851, he had been a rabbi of several small communities before. He was invited to become the rabbi of a group in Frankfurt am Main, in Frankfurt, Germany. But what was significant about this group was that Rav Hirsch was invited by this subset of the broader Jewish community, of the broader Orthodox community. Because the way that it was in most places in Germany was that you had a formal Jewish community that had representation which faced the government and interfaced with community members in a whole host of ways. Within that, there was, of course, by this time in 1860, there was a spectrum of different styles, I guess you could call them denominations, that were forming. So you had these new reform types of congregations, and then you had traditional, what you could call Orthodox congregations. You had one structure for the community. Rav Hirsch was not invited to be the community rabbi of the community organization to represent the entirety of the Frankfurt Jewish community. He was invited by a small subset of several hundred families to be the rabbi of their kehillah. Because there was this sense that they didn't feel that they could be part of the broader Jewish community. That's where Rav Hirsch goes in 1851. He establishes not just shul, but also a school. This is going to be the Torah in Derech Eretz. We don't have time this morning, in the limited time that we have, to to talk about, you know, Rav Hirsch and his whole legacy and the collected writings and KAJ and Washington Heights and Breuer's. But there's obviously, this is a whole world. We could spend a whole year just on Rav Hirsch. But I just want to focus this morning on this one nekuda, this one controversy. So we're going to leave the rest of Rav Hirsch for the moment. But in 1873, things start to change significantly in people's minds because a law passes in Germany. You know, by this time, Otto von Bismarck is coalescing Germany into a state. And a law passes that if you are a Christian community, you can secede from the broader Christian community and set up your own set of, communal norms and your own communal institutions, and you don't have to be part of the larger Christian community, which has its own standard legal representation, its own identity. So when Rav Hirsch heard about this, and a few others in the community, so there was one particular Jewish parliamentarian, they argued that just like the Christians can secede from the broader community, well, we should allow the same thing for Jews. And this is what Rav Hirsch championed, this Austritgemeinde or Geschäft or whatever they call it. They proposed a law in 1876, which was passed in July, to allow Jewish communities to secede from the broader Jewish context and form their own politic, their own entity. This was what Rav Hirsch championed. But this was not such a pasha thing. Even though Rav Hirsch was a great goer, and he was recognized as a living sefer Torah and a prominent authority in Germany, he wasn't the only. So somebody reached out, without discussing with Rav Hirsch, to the Würzburger Rav, and said, what do you think about this? About this idea of secession, of Austria? So it's interesting that the Würzburger Rav was not opposed to this in every circumstance. There's more to say about that. But he was opposed. Why? Because he learned from people who were involved that there was a negotiation that was going on. That the Jewish community as a whole was willing, the reformers who were in control, because the vast majority of Jews in Frankfurt were now Reform, they were willing to make accommodations for the Orthodox minority, that they could do their own thing and that they don't have to A, B, and C. So Rav Bamberger published a public notice. He published a public notice that given the compromises and the concessions that the Reform majority was willing to make, it would be preferable to remain as part of the broader community. And Rav Hirsch strongly disagreed. Rav Hirsch published two open letters to Rav Bamberger, and this became a tremendous source of controversy. Let's introduce one more figure into this picture, because Rav Hirsch is in Frankfurt, and the Würzburger Rav is in Würzburg, but there is a yeshiva. Where is the great yeshiva in the second half of the 19th century in Germany located? In a different city. Where is it going to be located? What's that? Any guesses? Where do you think? Nope. Berlin? Who exactly? Who is starting a yeshiva in Berlin? Maybe you could argue the greatest of all German Rabbanim. Before this, he was in Halberstadt. His name was Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. Zechut Tzadik Livracha. Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, some of you are familiar with the name, the author of many great tshuvas. He founded a German rabbinical school, which was called the Berlin Rabbinical Academy, but after he passed away, it was called the Hildesheimer Academy, based Medrash L'Rabbanim. This school was later headed by the Gaon Rav David Zvi Hoffman, later also by Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the author of the Sridi Eish. It was only closed because the Nazis closed it right at the beginning of the Holocaust. So it's really complicated because on the one hand, people looked to Rav Hildesheimer, who initially supported Rav Hirsch. On the other hand, Rav Bamberger was also closely connected with Rav Israel Hildesheimer. Rav Israel Hildesheimer had two students who were in conflict with each other. It even gets worse, because after the passing of the rabbi of the broader Frankfurt community, Rav Israel Hildesheimer had another student who was interested in the position who said no, and then there was a second student of Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who maybe you might have heard his name. He was known later by the name of his Judas called the Matel Levi. The Matel Levi was Rav Mordechai Horowitz. In German, his name was Marcus. Rav Mordechai Horowitz, he became the rabbi of the broader Frankfurt community, and he was a Talmud, a close Talmud of Rav Israel Hildesheimer from the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. He invited Rav Israel Hildesheimer to speak in his shul. Yeah. We're going to get to that in a second. We're just setting it up. We're going to see in a second. One second. When the Matel Levi becomes the rabbi of Frankfurt, Rav Hirsch puts him in Cheirem. But meanwhile, Rav Israel Hildesheimer, this is his Talmud. His Talmud asked him to come and speak. He was back and forth. He went and he spoke in the shul for Rav Mordechai Horowitz, and the people in Rav Hirsch's community were totally offended. They thought it was a slap in the face to Rav Hirsch. Because how could you go and speak in the community of your Talmud, but he's in Cheirem from Rav Hirsch? And apparently this debate, this controversy, although, as we'll see, it subsided in some level in a short period of time, because as you see on the timeline on your page, Rav Bamberger passed away just a year and change after this was enacted. But apparently, from what I read, there were still open wounds about this machlokas all the way until the Holocaust, until the communities were destroyed. And we'll talk a little more about where this went, but why am I bringing it up this week? Because it's Parshas Vayeshev, and it's a time when we need to think about controversies that cause rifts within families, within Jewish families, within the German Jewish family. And this is a very textured and complicated story. There are several articles which I could send you afterward. The Maisa with Rav Karlbach is from an article by Schneer Lyman. There are several posts about this machlokas between Rav Hirsch and Rav Bamberger, which are discussed at length. There's also an interesting article by David Ellenson on the life of Rav Israel Hildesheimer, looking at the different ways that he related to this controversy and other controversies regarding secession and other Jewish communities. But what I want to do primarily today is to look at a different article. Take a look on the next page, on page one. This is from Professor Leo Levy, where he summarizes and then translates. He translated several pieces from Rav Hirsch's open letters to explain what was Rav Hirsch, what was he upset about? What was it that really drove this issue? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I hear you, and as someone who majored in history, I have a great sense of sympathy for putting things in historical context. I suspect it actually was not influenced at all by the American context. This was an issue of how to deal with Reform Jews and the Reform movement. And that distinction between Jews and movement is what Rav Hirsch is about to introduce to us in a second. But it's an interesting ha'ara, right? We're talking 1876. Maybe William Henry Harrison was something around there, or one of those, or McKinley or somebody was the president at that time. It is in the wake of this American Civil War, but I do not believe that it has major significance here. I think what is important here, if you think about it from a historical standpoint, is that what we're seeing now is the effect, maybe it was intended or unintended, the effect of the emancipation of Jews in Germany and the Enlightenment. So, Napoleon and the emancipation of Jews creates this ripple effect where now people are enlightened and educated and open to the broader world, and now they have an opportunity to reform. Yes. Good. So that's what we're going to get at the end, to a section from Rav Shimon Schwab, who was not just from Baltimore. He was a rabbi in Baltimore for many years. He came from Europe. He was the leader of the German Jewish community. He says that some of this is unclear, and perhaps it could have come out differently if Rav Bamberger hadn't published publicly and Rav Hirsch hadn't published publicly. It's a good question. But as we say in this year, just the facts, ma'am. Right? I'm just telling you what it is. Try not to editorialize too much. That's the reality. And it's true. And sometimes maybe a conversation would have been better. So from one of the things that I read, it could be that part of the reason that Rav Hirsch responded with a public letter was that he was upset that the Wurzburger Rav would publish something without talking to him. Especially, and Rav Hirsch also commented the fact that the Wurzburger Rav was the Rav in Wurzburg, and I'm the Rav in Frankfurt. So it's my town, it's my psak, and we'll see in the end that this is, it's not going to be Rav Schwab, it's going to come back to this. So, in Achanami, maybe that's part of what we need to learn from this episode. Perfect. If you look on the bottom of your page, I gave you a Google map. This is, you see this? This is what, I'm sorry, you don't have it. Take a look, use my page. If you look on the bottom, I gave you a Google map. I Google mapped it from Frankfurt to Wurzburg. They didn't have a car. But if they would have had a car, according to Google Maps, the traffic shows it would have taken them, at least last night when I finished this, it would have, I don't know what time it was in Germany when it was after Shabbos I was doing the Google Maps, but the traffic was light, apparently, late last night. By car, it would have taken you 1 hour and 12 minutes. And I looked, I said, how long would it take to walk? Because they didn't have cars. It would have taken 23 hours to walk. So, okay, that, but they don't give you, for some reason in Google, they don't give you horse option, which would have definitely been the mode of transportation. They was either 7 hours on the bike. I was going to say, it's a bike option. 7 hours on the bike for those who are bike. Where's Nathan? That's no big deal. 7 hours. If they had a good train, or either the train or they would have taken a horse. But they're not that far. If you see on the map, this is Frankfurt on the Main River, this is Wurzburg, and this is Nuremberg. And you're talking central Germany. Okay, so what is the issue? What is the issue? Because Rav Bamberger, interestingly, even though he was known as a very staunch traditionalist, he made that compromise in his own shul, and his argument to Rav Hirsch was that if the reform are willing to make a compromise, you should also make a compromise. And in this regard, maybe you could argue, and this is a super simplification, but it's interesting to think about, Rav Hirsch was I don't know if you call it the inventor, they certainly invented the slogan of Torah Im Derech Eretz, but he was the proponent of Torah Im, as opposed to Torah only. You know, in Eastern Europe, and Dr. Lyman, the Heiliger Rav Schneer, living me well, he has a very long 123-page article where he talks about how, you know, Torah only, even in Eastern Europe, never meant actually Torah only. Even the Vilna Gaon, who was the chief of Torah only, he studied mathematics and he knew music and lots of other things. But to some extent, at least, you know, typologically, you could say in Eastern Europe it was Torah only, and Rav Hirsch was Torah and Derech Eretz. But this is why in life it's important not to make generalizations. You always, and we've talked about this before, you always have to descend into the particulars. Yes, it's true that Rav Bamberger was generally known as a very strong traditionalist, which is why Rav Shmuel Salant and he probably had a lot of things in common. And Rav Hirsch was, maybe you could argue, a modernist in some ways, at least from his dress. You see the picture of Rav Hirsch on the bottom left here on the page. It's quite a collar situation he has going on here. But when you descend into the particulars, you understand that people are more complex and situations are more complex. So, yes, maybe Rav Hirsch was progressive when it came to education in the German context and the importance of teaching kids secular studies. But at the same time, when it came to relating to the community, Rav Hirsch was unbending with Auschwitz. So let's see why. So it's important, you know, just you got to descend into particulars. You have to know the issue. You can't just say, oh, you know, just generalize about people. It doesn't work. So here, Professor Levy has two pieces from the letter where he makes key yesodos. So let's just go on the left side to the translation where he writes the translation. You can read the introduction later. You can get the full article. All the tradition articles that we quote are available on traditiononline.org. If you can't get it, I'm a subscriber because I'm an RCA member. I can get it for you, but I think they're now available for free for anybody in the archives. Very fascinating articles. Where it says page 339 to 340. The issue is not at all the separation between individuals. Says Rav Hirsch, this is not about how we relate to other Jews as people, as individuals. A withdrawal from friendly intercourse with brethren of differing religious convictions. This is Professor Levy's brief translation from the open letter in German. The issue is secession from all ties with minus. The distinction here, says Rav Hirsch, is between a min, a heretic, and minus, heresy, institutionalized heresy. From all ties with acknowledgement of opposition in principle to Torah and mitzvos. Not the secession from social ties with minim, with individuals who acknowledge such opposition in principle. It's not about the people who are not from. It's not about our cousins who unfortunately decided to leave the fold, or our other relatives or friends or children or parents. It's not about individuals. It's about an institutional position. It's not about minim, it's about minus.
It's not about apikorsim and things of that nature.
It's not about apikorsim, it's about apikorsus. That's the subtle distinction Rav Hirsch wants us to understand. He's saying, I can still be friends with my neighbor. I can still have a social relationship with a reform person in my community. But I can't, he says, have any working relationship with an institutional position, which is apikorsus. Thank God there are in our days no more minim in the sense of our codices concerning whom they teach us to avoid even mere contact. Rav Hirsch is now making another separate important observation, which is that in the Gemara's context, in the Rambam's context, when you talk about somebody who is a min, who is an apikores, that person, you can't have any interaction with them. Rav Hirsch is already acknowledging that in the 19th century, and this begins maybe most notably with his teacher, Rav Yaakov Etlinger, the author of the Binyan Zion, who makes a distinction between the traditional apikores and the reform and other modern, you know, the Zacharias Frankel was just starting conservative Judaism, they didn't call it conservative at that time. That in Germany, the Binyan Zion makes the following suggestion, that these people, these reformers, many of them, they are not a min in the classical sense in the Gemara, where you have to completely shun them, and it's a new kind of category. They were raised in an errant set of beliefs, of circumstances. They're raised in an Enlightenment era where, and this is what you'll hear in the contemporary halachic discussion over the past 150 years, we can categorize them as the Rambam does about certain people. In Hilchos Shabbos says, in Hilchos Shkagos, Tinok Shenishba. If you take a child, and the child was raised in a convent, lo aleinu, so for purposes of Chiyuv Chatas on Shabbos, are they treated like a regular person? No, because they had no awareness. They had no understanding. They had no context. So Rav Hirsch is acknowledging, number one, I'm not saying that all the Reform people in Frankfurt, they should be treated like minim, like apikorsim, like heretics in the Gemara. No. So number one, he says, we can be friends with them. And number two, it's because they're not traditional apikorsim in the Gemara sense. But again, Rav Hirsch is going to say that's true on an individual level. Now, it's really interesting. In Germany, a lot of the questions are coming up, and then it's going to spread. Can the counter-reform Jew as part of the minion? What's the story for, you know, Yerusha inheritance for Yibum? Because classically, the concept of a mumar, somebody who was an apostate, in the times of the Gemara, that meant they were completely and totally separate. They'd given up everything, and then in the early Middle Ages, that meant that they were joining a new faith, usually Christian. So how to deal with those people? Now we're talking about a new category of Jews. They're not becoming Christian. They're not traditional Mumarim in the Gemara sense. They're just Reform. So maybe some of them, unfortunately, don't believe in Torah Sinai. Maybe they put an organ in their place. They took out parts of davening, whatever. Rav Hirsch is saying, I have no problem relating socially and halachically to Reform Jews, as people. We are taught that Gentiles outside Eretz Yisrael are not considered idolaters, therefore there are no minim among the nations, and what we are commanded concerning the avoidance of contact with pagans doesn't apply to Gentiles, it's just minhag haseyim. So too, the same applies to our Jewish contemporaries who have adopted minhag and attitude and practice. They too are already the second and third generation, because we're writing now in 1870s. This is already 50, 60, 70 years.
Reform is like Christian.
He's saying the same way that Bismana said, the average Christians who live here in Skokie don't have the same halachic status as the Christians who were mamish fabrenta Christians in the early days of Oso Ish. So the same thing, the Reform Jews today, they don't have the same halachic status as the Reform Jews in 1810, who were mamish, they were mamish kofrim. They grew up in a firm environment, and they decided, we're going to throw it all away because we want to believe something else. He says, these are second, third generations. And what do we say today, lo aleinu, about people who are in the Reform synagogues and the conservative synagogues? How could they be called a min? They never even have a chance. And it's interesting that the Chazon Ish, remember, he's writing in Israel in the 1950s, 1940s. He also notes in a few places, this Chazon Ish is quoted a lot in this discussion about non-from people, he says the same thing about secular Israelis. Secular Israelis, they weren't raised in Germany in 1850, but if they were raised in a Chiloni household, how could you expect them to observe Shabbos? How could you be Mochiach then if they never had any context? Their parents grew up in some Stalinist commune called a kibbutz. Mamish, that's what was going on in the 1930s in Israel. So how do you expect that they're going to be religious, these kids or their grandchildren? It's not shayach, so you can't call them that they're a min, like it says in the Gemara, that you should push them down. The Chazon Ish says, you should try and embrace them, invite them for a Shabbos meal, show them what Yiddishkeit is, and maybe their children or somebody will be inspired. So if Hirsch says, I'm not telling you that you can't have anything to do with them. I'm not saying that on an individual level. Rather, he says, to them applies the perfectly what Rambam Maimonides teaches concerning the Apikorsim and the Karaites of his time. The Rambam is the same shtickle Torah with the Tinuk Shinishba. So we have to try to be friendly with them. But at the same time, on an institutional level, we can't have anything. Go to point number two. This is Professor Levy's translation of the second Nakuda. Our codices obligate us to far greater separation from minus. Minus means literally means heresy. Says Rav Hirsch, even from Avodah Zarah, from opposition in principle to Torah and mitzvah, than from idolatrous heathenism. Of minus it is taught, remove far from her your way, and only of minus, of those who come to her, none shall return. I recall Rabbi Tarfon's statement, even if a man chases after him to kill him, a snake to bite him, he may enter a house of idolatry, because it's pikuach nefesh, but not the house of minim. For they know and yet deny, while the former deny out of ignorance. Or Rabbi Yishmael, who permitted his nephew to die rather than be cured by a minim, although a cure by an idolater would have been permitted. The principle being here, minus is different, for it allures. He might be drawn after it. Go down a couple of lines. about, I put the next paragraph, there's a little break. Even to save my life, I'm in the middle of the paragraph. I may not say I were an idolater, and only to save my life may I give the impression I were an idolater. And then an Orthodox Jew should be permitted to join without coercion a Minos community, remain a member of a Minot community, Minos from which we must separate ourselves even more than from idolatry. Could there be a greater Chilul Hashem and strengthening of me in the midst? You can read the rest of the rule. Says Rav Hirsch, he says, absolutely not. He says, Minim, yes. And they're not technically Minim. We can be friends. We can have Thanksgiving dinner together. I'll cook. They'll come. But Minus, to be part of the institutional community, he says that would be lending a credence. And keep in mind, remember, we're dealing with a time and a place that was literally at the forefront of this struggle. Because it was a tidal wave of reform of now two and three generations of the Jews across Germany dealing with this challenge. Yeah. They had a rabbi and they had lots of different functions. So they were political, but also under the jurisdiction was lots of things. So they had one rabbi who was the rabbi of this kehila, so to speak. It's what we would call, we don't have such a thing so much, but it was kind of, if you imagine if you had the federations and all the synagogues belonged to a federation. You know, I remember a couple of years ago when I came to Chicago, and it's important when I tell you this story not to generalize, and it's important to understand this machlokas between Rav Hirsch and Rav Bamberger, but be careful before generalizing because you have to know all the particulars in your case. But when I came, I still remember that people in the federation community, they told me that Rav Avram Chaim Levin, Zichr Tzadik Levracha, that tells the Rosh Hashiva, he transformed the landscape of relationships between the Orthodox and the Federation world, which is primarily not Orthodox to my understanding, because when they went to raise significant funds for the Guaranteed Trust, there were many people in the film community who weren't going to participate because some of the disbursement of funds from the Guaranteed Trust, the JUF Education Fund, I think they raised that, I think about $33 million. That was going to be dispersed to non-Orthodox schools. And Rav Levin, Zichron Levracha, he ruled that it was permitted for Orthodox Jews to contribute to the Federation's fund. And it was a game changer. Many people have told this to me, that it was a game changer for the Guaranteed Trust here in Chicago to fund Jewish education. And of course, our Torah Dikas schools are huge beneficiaries. You know, Ari Crown and Hillel Torah, and we get tons, we get hundreds of thousands of dollars from this. So this kind of question, it keeps coming up. To what extent can we and we cannot? You know, the Kehila Fund, it only gives to the Orthodox schools. The Guaranteed Trust, it gives to everybody. So in every generation, we need to look at this with a fresh set of eyes. But what Rav Hirsch is saying to us is to understand the distinction between minim, individuals, and minus, as institutions. Yeah.
By not being the institution, aren't you then pushing more people towards intermarriage or way to the left?
So the question is, by not embracing, do we run the risk of ostracizing? Right. Yes, so that's what Rav Hirsch is saying. Rav Hirsch is saying, look, I'm going to look to the Pintel Yid on a personal level in terms of interaction. But as a matter of principle, I cannot and will not support a formal body that stands in contradistinction to Torah values, especially in the context of a struggle for what is to be defined as Jewish identity. That's what Rav Hirsch is saying. He's saying, if these people didn't represent themselves as Jewish, you know, if people don't represent themselves as Orthodox, they represent themselves as something else, it's less of an issue. The challenge, and we've seen this in recent decades with various movements that represent, everybody can say whoever they are, that's what they are, but the question is, you know, what does the Torah community say about that? So Rav Hirsch is saying, it could be that there is a price, and the question of, you know, who is right historically and who is wrong, I'm not sure how to answer that question. You know, to what extent was it successful or unsuccessful? There was a similar discussion in the 1950s about participating in the New York Board of Rabbis, where over a dozen very prominent Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Subalka Rav from YU, Rav David Lipschitz, and many others, they signed the ban, and Rav Soloveitchik did not sign. In every instance, you have to descend into the particulars to understand what the nekudas are. But this is a question that keeps coming up, but the distinction that Rav Hirsch is drawing is a crucial distinction that we need to keep in mind, that there's a big difference between interacting with people on a personal level versus giving an institutional gushpanka approbation to something that is misrepresenting, in our view, what is authentic Torah Judaism. Okay, I don't want to run out of time because I want to finish with this last piece. Take a look on the next page. What's interesting is that if we talk about how this dispute, this machlokas, went down, first of all, this article from Rav Shimon Schwab, who was certainly an insider in the Breuer's community, was the Rav of the Breuer's community, he came from this community, he emigrated to America in the early 1930s, I think. He points out that most communities across Germany did not follow Rav Hirsch's model. And even within Rav Hirsch's own community, of the hundreds who were members in Rabbeinu Hirsch's congregation, only 80 accepted his decision about Auschwitz. It was an unsolved question. It's interesting. Not Pashut. Most of the congregations didn't follow Auschwitz, and most of Rav Hirsch's own community members. But here is an interesting takeaway from this story. It quotes the following fascinating anecdote. The dispute between the two Gedolim was not an extended one because the Würzburger Rav passed away shortly after the controversy arose. In the year of his death, an anonymous sefer appeared bearing the title Divrei Emes. Although the author was unknown, it was clear from the depth of his writings that he was a veritable Talmud Chacham and that the book was written for the sake of truth. The Sefer contains many expressions of appreciation for the late Würzburger Rav and includes these sentiments: Namas kol lev, all hearts are melting. Chova al kol Yisrael lekra b'kriya she'ina al adam hagadol. Everyone in Klal Yisrael is bound to rend his garments at the death of such a great sage, etc. It goes on and on. The Sefer cannot say enough about the greatness of the Würzburger Rav, and yet its central theme is the refutation of his arguments regarding Auschwitz. It contains arguments that support the Hirschian view, and the author writes that by correcting Rav Bamberger's statements, he was redeeming the Würzburger Rav's reputation. Who could have written such a sefer? There is one clue. It contains the letters Hey, Chaf, Mem, which stand for Hareini Kaparas Mishkavo. I am the atonement for his bedstead. That is what a son should pronounce during the first year after his father's passing. I will atone for any sins my father has done. This indicates that the Sefer was put out by one of the Würzburger Rav's sons, all of whom were renowned Talmidei Chachamim. This son apparently felt that although his father was indeed a great gadol, he had made one error during his life. He had gone against the psak din of the Rav of the community and had not urged a disassociation from a group of heretics. Thus, Rabbeinu Hirsch's views were apparently shared by one of Rav Bamberger's own progeny. Fascinating footnote to the life of Rav Selig Ber Bamberger. So where does this leave us with a controversy that goes unresolved? I think with two things. One is that the question of how to relate to other Jews and a broader Jewish community is one which is complicated. And Rav Hirsch's distinction between minim and minus is important as a barometer going forward, whether or not most German communities accepted it or didn't accept it. And the second is to be sensitive now in looking back and thinking about, is there a way to avoid this type of acrimonious public debate? You know, Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, who was both the mentor in many ways of Rav Hirsch, and Rav Bamberger was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Beis Medrash LeRabbanim. He described in a letter that he lost many nights of sleep over this controversy. He lost a tremendous amount of sleep. And that maybe we need to try to find ways to create more of an inner dialogue together to be able to sort through these issues. Now, it could be that certain issues are going to be unsolvable. It's going to be impossible to resolve the differences. But is there any way that Rav Azriel Hildesheimer could sleep a little better at night? That we can resolve them in a way that we can understand that there are differences, but maybe we can emphasize the nature of Klal Yisrael? And it's true, in each generation there are unique challenges. Unique challenges to defining what constitutes an authentic Torah community and what's outside of a Torah community. But making sure that we emphasize the tzad that we are brothers. That even Rav Hirsch, who was the staunch proponent of Auschwitz and was so outspoken to defend it and criticize Rav Bamberger, he did so with the same acknowledgement that these Jews are still brothers. Because where did we go from the first original machlokas between brothers? We went down to Egypt. We went down to the worst, the beginning of all the exile. And so one of the things that we should maybe think about is that when we have these machlokas in between brothers, we not let them get to the point where Rav Azriel Hildesheimer can't sleep at night because he's so worried about the impacts of the machlokas. Yes, everybody needs to hold to their line. And if something in your tradition, for your gedolim, is minus, minus is minus. Heresy is heresy. But to be part of Klal Yisrael, until a person is absolutely, totally written off, completely, Rachmano Litzlan, keeping the frame, keeping the understanding that this machlokas is still a machlokas l'shem shamayim within brothers is an important thing for us to keep in mind in our day and in every generation.